This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. As you've no doubt been reminded, Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast 10 years ago this week. The damage it left in its wake is still being repaired. In many cases, it changed the trajectory of people's lives forever. That goes perhaps doubly for children. As she reports in her new book, Children of Katrina, Alice Fothergill says a dozen young people died in Louisiana. More than 5,000 children were reported missing, and over 370,000 school-age kids were displaced after the storm. 160,000 of those remained dislocated for years, and still others lost friends or loved ones. Fothergill is a disaster sociologist based at UVM. Her research, conducted with co-author Lori Peek over 7 years, offers the stories of 7 children between the ages of 3 and 18 and relies on broader research with well over 100 kids to explain and illustrate how children react to and recover from catastrophic events. Her research can be extrapolated to how children who were exposed to upheaval after Tropical Storm Irene might also be faring. The 4th anniversary of that storm is also this week. Today on the program, we're going to talk with Fothergill about children recovering from disaster. Alice, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Jane.
Could you tell us perhaps about one of the children that you followed as a way to get us into this idea of your broader research into how kids can react to and recover from disasters?
Sure. So we focus on the book on 7 children, and we present their stories. And one of those children is Jaron, who was 6 years old, African-American, lived with his mom. His parents had recently split up before the disaster, and so he, like others, had other things going on in their lives at the time of the disaster. So he evacuated with his mother and his maternal grandmother, and he did get out safely, and they moved from place to place to place, motels to shelters, a lot of displacement, and was lucky enough to end up in Louisiana in another city, and his mother was able to find steady housing. So they moved in, and so things looked pretty good, and his mother was able to find a job. So you would think in many ways that things were looking good. And a lot of people had worried about New Orleans schools. The schools were a little better where he was now. So the family was pleased, but he didn't thrive. And so it was interesting to watch his post-disaster trajectory. So what was happening? And he really illustrates the up and down fluctuating, because some spheres of his life, and we talk broadly about this sort of family as one, your peers and your friendship, your health, both mental and physical, extracurricular or recreational, housing and neighborhood, and finally school. So we look at those 6 areas of children's lives. So then we realize that the other parts of his life were not falling into place, and he missed his friends terribly. And he was scared about a new school, and he had a little trouble fitting in. They didn't like kids from New Orleans. He got in a lot of fights. He was so a lot of behavioral issues. He struggled academically, even though the school was better.
But he was six years old?
Wow. Right. So, but the main issue for him was that even though his parents had split up, he saw his large, extended, multi-generational family every day in New Orleans, a very tight-knit network. And when he relocated and he was with his mother and his grandmother, he didn't see any of them. And that was very, very difficult. And that was true for a lot of kids who were far from extended family, and they had been used to seeing them all the time and the support from them. So he really struggled. And so we had some areas of his life up, some down. Every time we went to see him, one was up, one was down. It switched. It looked very, at one moment, it looked like his mom might move back to New Orleans. He was so happy. He just felt like, right, that's where I should be. And then they didn't. So it was interesting to see. And over time, we noticed different things helped him. He got on a baseball team, and the coach was great, and he felt like part of a team, you know, and with close teammates. So there were ups and downs. But one thing that we really realized is if we had looked at 1 year out or 2 year out, but looking at all 7 years, we really saw this pattern of fluctuation.
Well, and that up and down, I mean, you can certainly think of an individual's life might have ups and downs.
Right.
And you're telling an individual story, but you're using it to illustrate what you see as one of 3 trajectories,
right,
or models that the kids that you studied really have in how they react to these disasters,
right,
and how they sort of move along in their lives post-disaster.
Right.
And you mentioned the upheaval model,
yeah,
that Jaron was a part of. So can you explain what that is, not just his story, but what that actually – why that's a specific model that you think is important?
Right. And if it's okay, maybe what I'll do is explain all three, so
right,
put it in context. So these patterns that we saw, we really wanted to understand what did children's lives look like afterwards over a long period of time, and no one had really done that. And so the first thing we saw was that some kids clearly declined. There was a declining trajectory. And we wanted to know, well, why are some kids declining? Some are fluctuating, and some have found equilibrium, finding equilibrium. And the declining trajectory, the children we saw most often in that trajectory were kids who were from who had the fewest resources. They were the most vulnerable, and they really suffered from cumulative vulnerability, one thing after another. So they had crises going on before. They often were from families in poverty or a family where maybe there was no employment. So they really struggled. So in a way, that wasn't a surprise. What was interesting for us to document was the evidence of all the ways that not having resources mattered. So clearly not getting out in time before the storm. So having sometimes life-threatening and very frightening and often traumatic evacuations. But all of the pieces afterwards of where they evacuated to and what kind of resources and services they got. So there were – in the declining trajectory, though, I should point out there were children who were not those clear – well, of course, okay, they were really struggling beforehand – it makes sense. Instead, they thought they were pretty steady beforehand, but it turns out their existence was much more fragile than they had realized. So families that were just making it, but making it, had plans for the future, rented their homes, had some possessions, had stability. And it turns out, as we know from the research, that many people are just one disaster away from severe downward mobility. So we did have that also in that pattern. And the second one, the finding equilibrium, not surprising, is most often these were the families with the most resources, what we called resource depth. So they really had things to draw from, financial, educational, professional, all of the social, personal. They really had resources. And that, again, all through before, during, and after played out in all sorts of ways. So the children in that one, what we really saw was families could use, for example, their social and cultural capital to help the children. So thinking of social capital as sort of the social networks, the connections you have to other people have value. So we think of it in terms of maybe finding jobs through someone you know. Well, that's valuable. And so these families were able to get information. They were able to evacuate ahead of time. They had networks outside of the city, unlike many people in New Orleans who – all of their networks were in New Orleans. So when New Orleans everyone had to leave the city, they lost all their networks, didn't have any resources to share. So resource poor networks. And then so these families had friends with extra rooms or even maybe an extra house, a second home somewhere, or grandparents who welcomed them in with plenty of space and resources to support them for as long as they needed. So those children were sort of buffered. They had very familiar surroundings. They were with people they knew. They knew everyone they knew was safe. They got a lot of information, and they had help with housing and employment. So those resources and the cultural capital is that we noticed that these families, mostly middle class, upper middle class families, sometimes with a lot of education, had this comfort level with dealing with bureaucracy and all of the bureaucracy that you must deal with after a disaster. The forms and the phone calls that you have to advocate and you have to argue and you have to go to the schools and you have to get your children in the classroom you want. And people say no and you have to say push back. And how to navigate that seemed to be much easier for this group, and how to say, I feel completely comfortable calling my state senator, and I am going to outline the ways in which, you know, I should receive more for my house or more considerations or more services. And then finally, I should mention for the finding equilibrium, sort of a hopeful piece is We did have a few families where the children found stability, but they didn't have all those resources. And that was really important for us to see because they had figured out ways to mobilize resources. And they were able to tap into institutional support. It sort of was a combination of institutional support, some parent or guardian who really connected that child to those institutional services, and then a child who really self-advocated, a child who really made the most of the services available.
So, and actually, yeah. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that later on, because that, you know, it's very almost depressing to hear you talk about these how socioeconomically divided these two trajectories are. And one of the things that we want to get into that's, you know, relatable to other disasters like Irene is, okay, so whether you have all those resources or not, how do you help children?
Right.
We're talking today with Alice Fothergill. She's a disaster sociologist at UVM, and her new book is called Children of Katrina. We're coming up, as you probably know, on both the anniversaries of Hurricane Katrina and Tropical Storm Irene. And listeners, I want to invite you into this conversation. If you have a story you'd like to share, an experience, or if you have a question about how to best advocate for children in these kinds of situations, how to make sure that your state, your community is positioning itself to be in good shape for kids before a disaster happens, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or write a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Okay, before we get into a little bit more about how to help, but also some of the other factors in whether a child declines or thrives, that middle section, the child like Jaren who is fluctuating.
Right.
If the people with more resources tend to find equilibrium, or their children do, and the people with fewer, by and large, are the ones that struggle the most, what characterizes that middle trajectory?
Right. They are sort of in the middle. They're not quite as vulnerable as those who decline, and yet they're not steady. So they really are a mixed pattern. And so there are two things. Some of the children went up in everything, all the areas of their life, and then down in everything. And some were more like Jaren, where they were up and down. Some of them, it was their pre-disaster environment playing out. So why didn't they decline? So in some of those cases, we found that these children had an anchor. And this is someone we identified as someone who was in their life before the storm and was there after. And they were just enough support. Often it was a grandmother who was able to make sure they didn't decline completely. And the reason they never found equilibrium is the structural disadvantages were just too great. And even though some spheres of their life were good, they just couldn't, all of them could not they couldn't find stability in all of the spheres. So the anchor was important and finding resources. It was really, those were very interesting for us to see. And it was amazing to us how every time we would visit, how different the children's lives would be. I should point out with these trajectories that all of the children, even the ones that found equilibrium, all of them had an initial decline. The storm, the disruption, the relocation was so hard on children that all of them declined. It was a hardship for all of them. And most of the children in Finding Equilibrium had less of a decline, and the depth and the duration of that decline was less. But they went through a lot also, and I think all of them were scared. They left their homes. They didn't know what was happening. So there was that decline for everybody.
Given that a lot of this does come down to socioeconomic structure and what resources are in place for families, how do you have any sense of whether the storm is really a factor in whether they decline or thrive or struggle through and have these upheavals?
Right. And that's a really good question. And we thought about that with a couple of the children in our study. Their circumstances were so dire beforehand, some who had even had homelessness beforehand, so they already had that unrootedness. It was pretty clear after 7 years of research that the storm had been an incredibly disruptive and significant point in their lives. And it was clear, learning about their pre-disaster lives and what was unfolding afterwards, that it was clear to us that the storm and the disruption afterwards played a very large role. We can never know, and it's not a true experiment of any kind. So we don't know, and it is possible that some of the children would have declined.
But can I just ask you, when you say declined, how are you defining that? I mean, how are we defining whether somebody is declining or, you know, finding equilibrium?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's sort of all of these terms, when people talk about recovery, there's a lot of different definitions of what recovery means. We were looking for this sort of some idea of stability, whether their lives had – they were thinking to the future. Did it have predictability? Did we sense a sense of security? So there's no one thing. With recovery, one of the things that's tricky is people often are looking for one moment in time when – people have recovered, or a community has recovered. Has your community recovered? Everyone always asks us, are the kids recovered? Has New Orleans recovered? And we always say, well, it's kind of hard to answer that question. And recovery doesn't really have an endpoint. It's this long process, and it's very uneven. And we see that with Irene, and we see it with Sandy. And we so it is it is hard to define recovery, and it's a little hard to – so as we thought about their lives afterwards, we really even moved away from saying, was this their post-disaster recovery trajectory, or is this just their trajectory and piecing through? But children's lives are hard because they change. They're developmentally, they're changing, and so it's not easy to tell how things would have unfolded otherwise, but just sort of using our best powers of observation.
We're talking with Alice Fothergill. She and Lori Peek have a new book out called Children of Katrina, and it's based on 7 years of research with many children who went through the storm in the New Orleans area. And they look at how these children have recovered and find three models that work to help describe how kids recover. A lot of it is based on socioeconomic status and what resources are out there for children and families after a disaster. As we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about how communities can make sure that they are structured so that children have the best chance of a good recovery after a disaster like Katrina or like Tropical Storm Irene. If you have a story that you'd like to share, or if you have a question about kids and catastrophic events like these, you can post a note at vpr.net, click on Vermont Edition, or call us. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Disaster sociologist Alice Fothergill from UVM is with us today. Her research on how children have fared after living through Hurricane Katrina has applications to Vermonters who suffered in Tropical Storm Irene. We're looking at what she and her co-author have found about how to help kids rebound. And if you have a question or a story that you'd like to share about Katrina or Irene, both anniversaries coming right up in the next few days, give us a call. 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Alice, the research in your book, of course, focuses on children who went through Katrina. But you were here in Vermont for Tropical Storm Irene. And in fact, the students in one of your classes at UVM spent most of their fall semester really intimately involved in watching what happened after Irene and how communities recovered.
Right.
So what parallels do you see between the two?
Right. So, yes, I had this wonderful opportunity right after the storm that I was teaching a sociology of disaster course. And so I met with my seminar and said, this is what I'd like to do. How do you all feel about this, having a service learning class? And they all were on board immediately. And they undertook all sorts of projects. A lot of them spent time on Randall Street in Waterbury, and a lot of them spent time in, I believe it was called Weston's Mobile Home Park in Berlin. So those were they spent most of their time, and they got they said that they learned more than they ever could have learned from reading the books in my class. So, or maybe it was a nice compliment.
Right.
So, but it was eye-opening for all of us. And one of the things I thought I would mention from that is, one, my students were fairly young, so they were almost, you know, they were, some of them, they're teenagers, so they were youth themselves, and they were excited to contribute. And one of the things that I noticed in both Berlin and Waterbury is, what the disaster scholarship often talks about communities becoming communities of sufferers after disaster, that people come together, they talk about altruistic communities forming. And this is a very important thing. Now, some people argue it doesn't always happen, and there are circumstances that doesn't allow that to happen. But we definitely saw this. I've seen this in Katrina in some parts, but in Irene, I really had the chance to see it in these smaller communities. And children and youth can be part of those. And that brings us to a larger point that we found in the book, was that children have these enormous capacities, and they can do all sorts of things for adults or other children or themselves. They have skills and talents, and they really are if they are able to participate in the recovery of their community, they are helping their own recovery and they're helping the community. And we saw a lot of that. We saw children helping their families clear out all their belongings from their mobile homes in Berlin and being part of that. And we saw children on Randall Street, especially the moment that sticks out for me is on Halloween, when Randall Street in Waterbury had their traditional trick-or-treating, but the homes weren't rebuilt. So the community had come together and candy had been donated, but kids were in charge of that effort. So what we saw was kids walking up and down the street with wagons full of this donated candy, making sure every home was prepared and that everyone had their pumpkin that was carved and brought to them, because people didn't have time to – they didn't have money to buy candy, and they didn't have time to carve a pumpkin.
And you think that's more than just a feel-good exercise or a short-term helpful thing for kids to do. This is important to their recovery?
Right. It's pretty well established, and work I did in New York after 9/11 and in Grand Forks, North Dakota after a flood there in 1997. The research is pretty clear that people really have – this very strong desire to help, and it's very important for them to find ways. And often there are barriers to that. 9/11, we saw lots of barriers. Grand Forks, North Dakota knew their flood was coming, so they actually could sandbag for weeks, mean building sandbag walls. Mm-hmm. And they even let their children, the schools were closed, so everyone could participate. And I just that was brilliant. And the kids really wanted to be part of that. And they felt enormous pride that they were part of this civic enterprise. So children and youth, absolutely, that it is they should be part of that effort for their own healing and for the community. I think it really builds that feeling of we are in this together. And it's a very important thing to establish in the aftermath.
We got a note from Seth in Brandon who says, while the homes on our street were untouched by Irene, the village business district around the corner was devastated when the river overtopped Route 7. In some ways, Brandon became what he's calling a Humpty Dumpty town, which could not be put together again. Mm. For 4 years, the town office building has been shuttered, and the two public parks in the downtown have been either partly or entirely closed. This Saturday, both parks will be reopened, a new deck overlooking the waterfall dedicated, and the town staff is expected to move back into the town office by year's end. Seth says, our three children have been awaiting the reopening of the parks. The youngest, aged 5, has no memory of what the parks look like behind the construction barriers. It has been a gap in their childhood that we are pleased to see remedied. The rebuilding process has been a lesson in both patience and perseverance for them and for our town.
Wow, that is a great comment, and it's exactly what I have found in other places after other disasters. And it's often not on the top of the list, but these parks and places where kids can have any kind of recreational activity are really important. I'm so glad they're reopening there. That's fabulous. And we saw in New Orleans, very tough, is they used every available space to put trailers on, so all the parks were full for years. There was no space, and we documented that very well. That was a big impact on children. They had nowhere to go to play. I'm glad to hear Brandon is reopening.
Let's go to Kathy, who's calling in from New Haven. Hi, Kathy. Go right ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
So I was in St. Bernard Parish, which is adjacent to Orleans Parish, 6 months after Hurricane Katrina. And the principal of the school in the area where I was determined to reopen the school to give the kids that sense of normalcy. And the kids were living in FEMA trailers with multiple siblings and any pets that had survived the storm and a parent or two that was out of work. So really, going to school and being with other kids was a saving grace. One of the most interesting conversations I had while I was there was with a teacher that she was delightful, and she had this class of really disparate kids that had never been in a classroom together before. So they didn't have any group norms. She didn't know these kids. And as she was facing this challenge of bringing this class together, and she was great, she told me her own story of the stresses that she was facing. And so we were putting an enormous amount of hope and responsibility into a teacher in this kind of a community. So I wondered if in looking at how you can help the kids, if looking at how you can help the focal points of their attention was addressed.
Kathy, thanks for your call. Alice Fothergill?
Yeah, wow, that's a great, great observation, and sounds like an amazing teacher. So we found this everywhere in New Orleans. The teachers had also often lost their homes, and they were under a lot of stress, and they were pretty amazing trying to pull these classes together. And so I think that's really important to point out that they have their own stresses. We went in a lot of schools and talked to a lot of administrators and teachers, and they needed a lot more support. And one thing we found is a lot of the schools we went into, they didn't have social workers or any counselors. And so teachers were also doing that job, and they weren't necessarily trained or had the time. And it was very surprising to see these situations where it was clear they really needed a counselor or a social worker or someone on staff to help. To help the teachers who had these enormous jobs. And you're absolutely right. The home life was so unsteady that the caller makes this important point that the schools became this point of normalcy and routine. And so schools are just incredibly significant in the child's recovery.
Alice, you were mentioning earlier that some of the key factors in determining whether a child is going to fall into a trajectory where they find equilibrium after a storm, or they really are, you know, having dips and troughs, or where they're declining, a lot of it has to do with institutional disadvantages that they faced even before the storm. Mm-hmm. And then some of the resources that these children had before the storm, like close-knit family units or communities, right, were really just torn apart by the storm. So given that, how have you found that we should all be thinking about ways to help after a disaster occurs? And then maybe if we have time, we can also talk about what your thoughts are on how to position ourselves so that we're helping even before a disaster occurs. But what about right afterwards?
Right.
What should people be doing?
Well, and you make an important point. Really, all of this should happen beforehand. So all of these plans should be in place, and we should be doing a lot of preparation beforehand. The Katrina was enormous. It's hard to even, you know, describe how large this disaster was and this displacement. People talk about it was the largest displacement of people since the Dust Bowl. It was
in the United States.
In the United States, and people went to all 50 states, and people couldn't get back home. So, you know, understandably planning for all of their educational plans afterwards. But schools needed support in terms of incorporating new students and just having some understanding of what's the best way to incorporate them. So we talked to teachers. We traveled as the children in our study moved to new cities. We traveled too. They go to Atlanta. They go to Dallas. We followed them. And it seemed that having a familiar face seemed to be a nice thing. Oftentimes they would distribute the evacuee children, you know, a few to every class. In some schools they put them all together, but that was a little isolating. But having a familiar face being – and a lot of schools did a lot of things that were really helpful. They had to waive certain things like uniform fees or vaccination records and things that, okay, let's get these kids into the classroom. So – but we definitely have to really just think about making and are planning making children a priority. And after Hurricane Katrina, I think we realized, sort of like the story that Kathy raised, is that we this didn't work. We made a lot of mistakes. And so George W. Bush, President George W. Bush in Congress, decided that we need to make sure that children are not as vulnerable next time. And they established a National Commission on Children and Disasters, which was fabulous. And that commission met many times over years and came out with a report. And so this year, now 10 years later, how are we doing? And so when we look at the recommendations and how we have done as a nation, and these are all about they cover about elementary education, secondary education, mental health, physical health. We see that we haven't met 79% of the recommendations remain unfulfilled.
That's nationally?
Yes.
Is Vermont doing any better?
Yes. So Vermont, actually, Save the Children does a report card, and they put the results of state by state. So you go in to see Vermont, and Vermont has good marks in all areas. So we're doing a lot of things right. And we actually are making headway on preparing child care centers. We have some new initiatives. We're going to have sort of comprehensive disaster plans for child care centers, which are often overlooked when talking about children. We think of K-12, but sometimes we don't think about child care centers. So yes, so we're making great progress.
Nonetheless, it sounds like from your research, Alice, really poverty and institutional disadvantages,
yes,
if those don't go away, we're still going to see
absolutely
children struggling.
And a lot of the things that we are dealing with in non-disaster times, like affordable housing, those are the things that matter after. So a lot of the issues are the same. It's poverty, it's hunger, it's having good housing. So a lot of the same things.
Disaster sociologist Alice Fothergill, the UVM professor's newest research, is published in the book she co-authored with Lori Peake. The book is called Children of Katrina. Alice, thank you so much for talking with us.
Yes, thank you.
Coming up, how Vermonters are helping out with forest fires out west. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The forest fires in California and the Pacific Northwest may feel very far away, but crews of local firefighters and Forest Service staffers have been rotating out to those locations all summer to provide relief and assistance in fire suppression. David Francombe is the Manchester District Ranger for the U.S. Forest Service. I talked with him on Monday about what the Vermont personnel do when they rotate out west to work on these fires.
Well, it depends on what training and qualifications they have, but the way the system works is the Forest Service is kind of broken down into 9 regions, and within each region you can make yourself available. And then the incidents across the country are managed on a national level, and as an incident puts in a needs request, they'll look at what resources are available, and then they'll dispatch different groups of people or different individuals from different regions across the country. So you could have a hand crew that goes out as a group of 20, and they'll be fighting fire directly on a fire line, or if you go as a single resource or you're part of an incident management team, you'll have more of an administrative type of job, maybe participating in planning, operations, logistics, or finance, administrative needs on a fire, possibly serving in the role of a safety officer or even a public communications officer.
So really all kinds of people are needed for this kind of work.
Yeah, it's a big variety, all types of people. So again, you have your experienced firefighters, but you also have a bunch of folks that have a lot of resource knowledge. So they're going to have the knowledge on, the types of vegetation in the area, the wildlife that might be impacted, different archaeological or cultural sites. So yeah, I mean, the Forest Service is well adept at serving in this capacity or fulfilling these types of roles, and we have the staff that are trained and qualified to do those types of things.
So it sounds like it's pretty common then for people in our region to be heading out during forest fire season.
Yeah, it's common in a year like this where there's high fire activity kind of concentrated in one location. There's not a whole lot going on in the Northeast as far as fire this year, but nationally we're at the highest preparedness level. So when you're at that kind of a planning level, Forest Service employees are encouraged to make themselves available if they can fit it within their work schedule.
Do you know locally how many people have gone out this summer to out to the West and the Pacific Northwest?
Green Mountain Forest National employees have had about 9. Some of those have served on, we'll call it like an interagency hand crew team. So we had 4 United States Forest Service employees from the Green Mountain on that team, along with a number of employees from the White Mountain National Forest, as well as the National Park Service employees. So it's kind of an interagency type of team. And then we've had a number of individuals who are out on in an individual capacity, kind of filling different jobs on different assignments out west.
And it sounds like more to go. I know Ethan Reedy, who's a public affairs officer, is headed out.
Correct. He went out to Portland to serve as a public affairs support. And then we've got another couple individuals, I think, who are going to be participating on another crew of some sort. So they'll be dispatched here shortly. We're anticipating.
One of the people in your office has just come back. I understand Keith Sargent was a crew chief for a group of firefighters, and you have him on the line now?
That's correct. So Keith is our visitor information services individual at the office. He's our face to the public. So when you walk in our office, he'll be the first individual you'll come in contact and interact with. But he has a whole other set of duties within the fire organization, the Forest Service, and he recently got back from California.
Well, let me talk to him if you don't mind.
Okay, here he is.
Hello, Jane.
Hi, Keith. Nice to talk with you. Can you tell me a little bit about what you actually do on the ground when you go out and sort of drop into one of these fires?
As a member of a hand crew, typically you'll be right on the fire line. Your duties can vary from cutting hand line, direct fire line, to prepping line for indirect burnouts, mopping up the fires.
When you say cutting line, what does that mean?
You will go directly to the fire and remove vegetation, kind of make a fuel break to hold the fire.
Each fire is different, of course, but you're trained to understand how fires work and how to fight them, and specifically, I imagine, trained on forest fires. So when you go in, does it feel like your training prepares you for whatever you've got in front of you, or is it kind of difficult to step in the middle of a fire that's already going and a firefighting operation that's already in progress?
It's the same process wherever you go in your training. You rely on that. You definitely defer to local expertise on specific tactics, but there's a very structured procedures that we have. You know, no two fires are the same, but you're usually very confident with how you approach things.
Well, Keith, could you talk a little bit about that? I mean, around here, we're more accustomed now to structure fires than forest fires, at least in the modern era. And when you're fighting a fire that's burning thousands of acres, maybe hundreds of thousands of acres, and the number of firefighters and the distance that you're coordinating over is vastly different than what we are most accustomed to here. Can you talk a little bit about how that organizational structure works?
Yeah, it's somewhat of a militaristic structure. It's the incident command system. It's really nice because both the military, the state, and the federal, we all operate within that system. So we have the same definitions, the same procedures, and that makes things a lot less confusing because we respond to not only wildfires, but hurricanes, floods, different natural disasters.
So are there sort of teams that are at different points in the fire and you're coordinating back with a base?
Yeah, they'll set up an incident command post, and they'll usually have a team in place, and there's different levels of teams depending on the size and the complexity of fires. But we work for them, and you report back to that incident command post.
How many firefighters might there be on one of these big fires?
It can vary. Sometimes they'll break off, and it can be responding to a lightning tree strike, and it could be just a single squad of 6 people going up and securing that one small fire, all the way up to, like you mentioned last year with the Rim fire, thousands of firefighters. So.
Wow. Why do you do it?
I enjoy the challenge. I really like the outdoors. So for me, the idea of hiking to these remote areas and being able to help, it's been really rewarding to do that. But I think a lot of it, the appeal is just the challenge of it, working in a team atmosphere under adverse conditions and just growing as an individual. And it can be a really rewarding experience. It's a lot of hard work.
Well, and as we've seen this year and other years, it can be dangerous work.
Yeah, you do the best you can to mitigate any hazards out there, but it can be dangerous at times.
Well, Keith Sargent, thank you very much for talking with me. Do you mind putting David back on the line?
No, not at all. Have a great day.
Hello, Jane.
Hi, David. It was great to talk to Keith to learn a little bit about what's happening on the ground. I imagine you've probably done this kind of stuff as well, rotated through and gone out to forest fires.
Yeah, so when I started my career at the Forest Service, I was just, they call it a firefighter type 2, so it's just a basic wildland firefighter. So I got out on a number of different assignments across the West. And then I also served as a single resource in support of fires as a geographic information systems guy. And what that is just that's mapping, providing different maps for the planning team and for the fire crews as they go out and work on an active fire.
When so many Forest Service personnel are being pulled from their normal locations, and we're hearing right now in the Pacific Northwest, they're even pulling firefighters from Australia and New Zealand, which of course is the Southern Hemisphere, so it's not their fire season. But when so many U.S. Forest Service personnel are being pulled off, how does that affect local operations when you've got people missing from your office?
I mean, when you have four or five individuals out of an office with a staff of about 15 permanent employees, it can definitely have some of an impact, but Forest Service is great about kind of cross-training employees and employees stepping up and helping out. So most times when you have a group of employees gone, people are willing to step up and kind of fill in behind them and help out. So it adds a little bit of stress maybe to the work environment while they're gone, but I think it's for the most part very manageable.
That was David Francombe, Manchester District Ranger with U.S. Forest Service. Earlier, we heard from firefighter Keith Sargent. They've been explaining how Vermonters are rotating through the ranks of firefighters and support personnel on major fires in western states. And now it's time for the mailbag, when we read your comments and emails. And I'm joined now by Vermont Edition managing producer Patty Daniels. Hi, Patty.
Hey, Jane. We love getting comments and questions. They often come in after the show. We're going to take a moment to share a few. Last week, we discussed the role of private mental health practitioners in Vermont. And Jean from Brattleboro is one herself, and she writes about her experience. We do not tend to go into this work for profit. Over the last 30 years, my income has decreased by approximately 19%. The insurance industry allows us 45 minutes in which to assess a new patient for their degree of safety and all the other complexities that go into formulating a diagnosis. I run all my intakes for almost double the amount of time allotted. Psychotherapy has been highly undervalued by the medical profession as a whole, and of course by the insurance industry specifically.
And Nancy writes, private mental health clinicians are a huge resource in any community. Anything that can be reported and debunked about us can do a lot to help diminish the stigma still attached to seeking therapy and reduce the myths and assumptions about the accessibility of this resource.
Earlier this week, we spoke with Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb about the results of the new Smarter Balanced Standardized Test that were made public on Monday. Holcomb urged Vermonters not to be alarmed by the relatively large percentages of students who did not achieve a score of proficient on the test.
Well, that kind of rankled Mark. He heard the show and he posted this reaction on Facebook. What I heard was a very dismissive attitude on the part of the secretary on the testing process, something akin to, if you don't score well on the test, all that means is you didn't score well on the test. Mark says, while that may work for one student who has a problem taking tests, if an entire class does poorly, then that cannot and should not be dismissed.
All right. Well, switching topics. On Tuesday's show, we talked about herpetology. And that discussion of reptiles and amphibians had many variations on the theme of how do I help X animal cross the road?
Ba-dum-bum.
Ba-dum-bum. Regarding turtles, Sean in Moncton gives this advice. If you see one on the roadside, you can help it by moving it in a straight line in the direction it was already pointing, possibly towards water. Don't throw the animal in the water, please, says Sean. Just help it cross the dangerous roadway, and it can take care of the rest from there.
We should point out that Jim Andrews, our herpetology guest on that show, had some specific advice for catching snapping turtles, which is that they have a very long neck. So don't hold the turtle by the sides of its shell. If it's a big snapper, you can grab it at its feet, at the base of its back feet, and pick it up that way to help it across the road. All right, and Robin shares this observation from Rochester. We have a pond that every spring is filled on the edges with groups of frog eggs in large diaphanous clusters. What's troubling is that salamanders have free rein to consume the eggs. They just mosey through the egg sacs and consume the embryos without anyone around to say, that's not nice.
Okay, so I love how we're personifying all of our reptile and amphibian friends.
And our listeners.
Regarding the fungal disease that is decimating the tiny population of rattlesnakes in Vermont, Kathleen posted this comment. The noun phrase snake fungus is equal in appeal to the word moist. And Kathleen, I have to agree with you on both counts. What we would love to hear, though, is what makes you happy, not what grosses you out. So please tell us what topics you'd like to hear on Vermont Edition. Get in touch with us on social media or send your comments to vermontedition@vpr.net.
All right. Thanks very much, Patty.
You're welcome.
That does it for today's show. The gubernatorial election is more than a year away, but the list of potential candidates is already long. So far, only one person has actually made a formal announcement, House Speaker Shap Smith, and he will join us tomorrow on Vermont Edition to talk about the race and his platform. So send your questions or comments for Shap Smith to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen to the program tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.